Great. Well, good morning. It's fantastic to be here this morning to take us forward into our next sermon for our sermon series, which is our Go series. And today we're going to be looking at work. How do we go as Christians into the workplace? So my background, 16 years as an officer in the Royal Navy, 15 years in seagoing appointments. I've been privileged enough to command three different ships for in total about 6.5 years. And I'm now in a role in the Ministry of Defence up in London, working on the Strategic Defence Review. So I've worked with many different people in a number of different settings, and in some really challenging circumstances. And I've often thought, what does it mean to be a disciple in the workplace? Are we just Christians between the hours of 10 and 12 on a Sunday morning? Are we only doing God's work if we are on the church premises? Or we're a missionary in the mission field? Or doing charitable work? How do we go into the workplace, into our offices, into our factories, into the production lines, into the shops or gardens or whatever setting it is that you work in? How do we do that? What does it mean for you, and what does it mean for your colleagues? Now, I know one or two of us in the congregation might be retired, but this still applies to you, so don't switch off or zone out. Whether you are working voluntarily or you are a parent or grandparent, working to be a good parent and grandparent, it still applies to you, so please do listen in. So what we're going to cover then is that we can only be effective in our work in spreading the gospel if we have a biblical perspective of our work, of ourselves at work, and of our colleagues. So we're going to look at those three points this morning. So firstly, our work. How do you view your work? How do you classify it in the spiritual sense? In church, I'm doing God's work, but out there, I'm earning a living, earning the money to pay the mortgage. Now, the salary, of course, is undoubtedly a motivation. But if we think in these terms alone, then we'll make no effort to engage our faith in our workplace. It will be purely transactional. It'll be perhaps the path of least resistance, perhaps the easier option. But we know that the easier option isn't always the best way. And it's not going to fulfill our God-given purpose. It will bear no fruit. And as we can see from these readings, it's certainly not biblical. Unless we understand that Jesus is the King of every part of your life, then we might have this view. Jesus is not one day a week. He's not Sundays only. He's the King of Monday, Tuesday, and so on. He's the King of those moments when you're getting up at 6:30 and it's tough, and you're waking up to get in the car, to commute, to get to work, to get through the day. He cares. He is the King of all aspects of our lives, whether it's pleasure, leisure, relaxing, but also our work. So we need a better understanding of work. We need biblical theology to shape how we view our work and to transform it from a process, from a transactional way of life, making a living to pay off the mortgage, into something tremendously powerful and honoring to God. And we see this in our first reading this morning. We see the value of work right at the beginning of the Bible. Right at the start, God was at work. when God created the heavens, the earth, the land, the sea, the waters swarming with life, the creatures on the land, and he made mankind, he was at work. How do we know this? Well, it says so. In chapter 2, verse 2, it says, "And on the seventh day, God finished his work that he had done. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work that he had done." So God was at work. He was creating. He was bringing things into life. He was designing. And so he rested on the seventh day. What was he resting from? He was resting from the work that he had brought to be. So when everything was perfect, right at the beginning, there was work. And God's work in Genesis was beautiful. It was perfect, majestic, and it brought him glory. So work then was good. We need to get out of this idea that there was this some sort of golden age of leisure before which work came to be. No, work was there right at the beginning. And therefore, it's a central aspect of who God is. And we can see that from the reading. We also see that we have been given a role and responsibility. So in chapter 2, verse 15, it says, "Then the Lord took man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it." So man and woman was given a job to do, to work in the garden, tending it and making sure that it was looked after and that it was pruned and cultivated. So right at the beginning, man was created and he was given a job, just like we have. So work is central to God's nature, but it's also central to our nature as men and women working in this world. So in many ways, Genesis is the story of work. God at work and man at work. And work as a central aspect of life. So it can't be then that work is just a transactional process. We go out there, we earn a living to pay the mortgage and to put food on the table. It's much, much more than that. It's much more central to who we are in our faith. It's much more important. Martin Luther, the great reformer, built on this. And he looked at areas in the Bible when he developed his theology of work, the doctrine of vocation. And it's very powerful. It gets to the heart of how we are to view our work today. You see, we live in a culture that values only certain types of work, you know, successful work, high-paying work, or, more recently, work that directly helps others. But the Christian view of work is very different. Our faith gives us the concept that all work has dignity and value. All work is important, even the boring, even the perhaps what society would not value, the perhaps more menial tasks. What Luther says and what we can see from the Bible is that all forms of work are valuable and that are important to God. So how does he do this? Well, he points to Psalms 145, 146 and 147. And in 145 verse 15, a psalm praising God that describes God at work. It says in verse 15, "The eyes of all look to you, and you give them their food in due season." And Luther would say, well, how does God give us food in due season? Does it miraculously appear? No, it's through the farmer that plants the seed and harvests in season. It's through the factory worker that is working the machine to produce or purify the milk, or that bakes the bread. It's through the lorry driver that gets up in the middle of the night to fill the lorry and to distribute it to the various supermarkets. It's through the checkout person. It's through the person stacking the shelves. All these people are doing God's work. They are feeding us. Another example he points to is in Psalm 147, verse 13 to 14, where it says, "For he strengthens the bars of your gates. He blesses your children within you. He makes peace in your borders." And here Luther makes the point that God makes us secure. We're very privileged in this country to live in a secure and safe society. Well, how is that achieved? It's through the institutions of the state. It's through law and order. It's through diplomatic and security services. It's through the police officer on patrol. It's through the social worker dealing with a troubled case. It's through the prison officer on guard. Through the politicians and the staffers. And through the members of the armed forces on duty 24/7, 365 days a year. You see, without any of these people, we wouldn't be here. We would starve, or there would be chaos. There would be no law and order. And that is not part of God's plan. From his word, we can see that his plan is to feed us, to look after us, to care for us, and to live in peace and security. So how does God give us food in our due season? Through the work of these people. How do we have peace and security? Through the work of these people. And so through these examples, and there are others, we can see that all work is valuable to God. Every area is important to him. So asking that question again, how do you view your work? Do you realize that you were created for work? That work is in your DNA? It is a part of you. Do you realize that God has given you a role and responsibility in this world to care for his creation? Do you realize that all work is valuable to him? Your work matters. What you get up to do this week on Monday matters. It is important. God cares. So if we have this biblical view of our work, it should change the way we approach our work. If it's God's work, we should want to do it well. We should want to honor God with our work, working conscientiously when no one is working. We say, well, how do you do it well? Well, the doctor diagnoses the illness. The gardener makes sure that the plants are tended and looked after. The lorry driver gets his consignment to its destination on time. The airline pilot lands the plane. Be the best doctor. Be the best gardener. Be the best bricklayer, software engineer you can be. Whatever it is that you're working at, do it for the Lord. So that's the first part, our work. Second part, the workers, ourselves. How do you view yourself at work? Well, our faith gives us an anchor without which work would destroy us. You see, work at the beginning was perfect. But of course, with the fall, sin was introduced. And work is imperfect. There are tough moments. There are tired times. And without our faith, work could destroy us. We live in a culture fascinated by success. Finding, achieving, even projecting success. That's what this society cares about. Instead of the search for meaning, there is the search for success. You see it all the time. We celebrate those who are successful. The gold medalists. And sometimes we can be in danger of worshipping success or those who succeed. And as such, we can be paralyzed by a fear of failure. And we see that in our second reading, in Luke 10, verse 1 to 21, we see that Jesus makes it clear that failure will be as much a part of our lives as breathing. We see how Jesus speaks about success, but he also speaks about failure. How we might avoid being seduced by success, but also avoid being frozen by failure. So the first thing we see in this passage is that Jesus promises that we will have successes and failures. You know, we're going to succeed and we're going to fail. At the beginning of this passage, Jesus starts by giving the disciples, the 72, a pep talk. And just like any good leader or any good captain of a ship, he gives a pep talk and he's trying to boost his team. He talks about the positives. I am sending you out. There is a harvest that is plentiful. But he also talks about being sent out like lambs amongst wolves. He wants them to know that just because he is sending them, and just because they are obeying him, it does not mean that we are guaranteed to succeed. There is a threat. There are wolves. There will be wins, but there will also be losses. There will be moments of great reward and success, but there will be also moments of failure and disappointment in our lives. It's no guarantee. There will be peaks and troughs. And that's because we're being sent into contested ground. Every inch is contested. Every moment at work will be contested. So there will be successes, but there will also be tough times. Things will go wrong. Businesses will struggle. You might be criticized unfairly. You might be given a frustrating task without thanks. You might be rejected by a colleague. But in this passage, Jesus says, dust yourselves down and keep going. You see, if you fear failure, you'll insulate yourself in your life. You will seek to protect yourself, to prevent the bad things happening. And what will happen is it will insulate you from opportunities, from moments of great joy. Because there's only joy found on the other side of those moments of risk, of faithfully stepping out of your comfort zone and working for God and his purposes. The other thing we can see from this passage is that Jesus actually redefines what success and failure is. Jesus shows that he's not fazed by failure. He says, whoever listens to you, listens to me. But whoever rejects you, rejects me. He doesn't want them to be unduly affected by it. It's so easy, isn't it, to base our identity on our activities, on our careers, on our roles, our positions or our status, our wealth and our reputation. David Lloyd Jones, the minister and doctor, remarked that there were a lot of medical men in his time who he knew that when they died, you could put on their gravestone, born a man, died a doctor. What he meant was that those people can't imagine themselves not being a doctor. It was central to their self-confidence, their identity. It was wrapped up in their work. But the trouble with that is that when we succeed in our activity, we will grow in our sense of identity. But when we fail, it will diminish it. And we will all fail from time to time. In May last year, I had the privilege of captaining HMS Scott, which is the fifth largest ship in the Royal Navy. And we were tasked with taking part in New York Fleet Week, which is a fantastic occasion. It's where New York celebrates the US Navy in particular, but they invite their allies and partners to take part in it. And we were lucky enough to be the British ship that went along. And the first day, you sail up the Hudson to go alongside in Manhattan, and we were sailing up behind USS Wasp, a big American aircraft carrier, and they went alongside, and then it was our turn, and it's high pressure. You know, in Manhattan, there's many windows and lots of people watching. And the first time, went in, you turn sort of 90 degrees, go up the river, turn at 90 degrees to go alongside the jetty. The ship came in alongside beautifully. It fitted like a glove, and I was very relieved because obviously I was the one giving the orders and instructions to berth or to park the ship. The second time, however, because we had to move from the berth, because a cruise ship needed to go in and they've got the money, we had to go to anchor in the Hudson, which was, again, no great problem. What an incredible thing to do. But we anchored there, and then the next morning had to get up early to go back alongside. So this was take two, and it didn't go so well. The conditions on the morning were completely different. The tide was much stronger than I anticipated. And so when I turned at 90 degrees to go into the berth, I'd left it too late. And the ship got taken by the tide, and I had to take some really strong maneuvering to get out of the problem, because otherwise, a moment later, the ship would have crashed. And again, with lots of people watching. But at that moment, it was a real sense of failure. Very public. And I'm sure you've all had those moments as well in life, where you've made a mistake, you've not judged something quite right, or you've said the wrong words at the wrong time. You see, in many ways, Jesus was a failure. He was a carpenter, but we don't read of his successful business or that it formed a central element of his identity. He was a rabbi, but he wasn't very successful. Most people he spoke to rejected him. His talks weren't easy to follow. He had to take time after each one to talk it through with the disciples about what it actually meant. He spoke in riddles. He actually gave talks that we can see in John 6, where he lost more followers than he gained. He was criticized by so many people. People plotted against him. They called him evil. He had enemies on every side. People hated him, and he died on a cross. You see, our culture often overstates relationship status. But Jesus never married. He never had children. He kept poor company. And most of his friends deserted him, and some even betrayed him. In many, many ways, then, his life could have looked like a failure. But in the Gospels, he never seems fazed or troubled by this. He had so many chances to turn it around, so many chances where he could have said, no, I'm going to put the success, the short-term success, over the long-term goal. He could have tried to avoid looking like a failure, but he doesn't do that. He doesn't identify with temporal success. He doesn't take what others perceive as failures personally. It does not form his identity. He says, they will reject you, they will reject me. But actually, they're rejecting the one who sent me. So where is Jesus' identity? It's rooted in the voice of the Father, his baptism. This is my son. To Jesus, failure is disobedience to his Father. He redefines what failure looks like. He also redefines what success looks like. The disciples, they return from their time out spreading the good news. They return and they are buzzing. They are on fire. Even the demons submit, Jesus. But Jesus responds, doesn't he? Don't rejoice that the spirits submit to you, but rejoice that your names are written in heaven. Now, it's good, isn't it, to rejoice in success and celebrate when things are going well. That's absolutely right. But Jesus sees how quickly we tie our joy to our achievements and our success. If I succeed in that exam, then I'll be joyful. If I get that profit level, I'll be happy. If I gain those extra students, I'll be content. You see, if your joy is linked to your success, then you will always be constrained by it. If your sense of worth is in your achievements, you will fall apart when they fail. If your identity is constructed on your victories, you will be destroyed by your defeats. Don't base your success on your temporary circumstances. Base it on your eternal significance. Instead, Jesus says, rejoice that your names are written in heaven. It's easy to spend our lives trying to make a name for ourselves. God has put eternity in our hearts, so this isn't all bad. But we see so many, and perhaps we strive to do the same. Strive to make a name for ourselves. We see so many who place their names or determine to place their names in the history books or spend millions giving their names to a museum or a library or just to buy a park bench. But we can trust Jesus with our reputations. Jesus can raise you up in a moment. The Spirit can breathe on an idea, a plan, or a moment of leadership. Jesus has lifted your name higher than you could ever do. He's lifted your name higher than you could spend a whole lifetime trying to. Your name is engraved on his hands. It's in the highest place. That means you can take risks in obedience to him. It means you can go all in for the kingdom of God. You can speak to people in your workplace, knowing that your reputation is secure with God. You don't have to fear failure when your name is in the highest place. It means you can enjoy success without it seducing you. It means you don't have to be frozen by failure. So we have a right view of work. We have a right view of ourselves at work. We can recognize how that frees us to live a life for God in the workplace. God has put you there for a reason. You're there to do his work. Think back to the Luther example. The same applies to you. Wherever you are, wherever God has placed you, you are there for a reason. With those colleagues or with those customers, you represent God in that place. If you don't, no one else will. No one else will. It's up to you. So we can take our Christian values and those can shape our workplace. We can demonstrate the love of Christ because we know the value of our work and we know and have the right view of ourselves working. And of course, we can demonstrate the love of Christ serving our colleagues each day. You will need to think about this for your own particular setting. It might mean a show of integrity. if you know a product is faulty, not putting it on sale. It might mean not gossiping about that person that everyone knows is really difficult, really challenging to work with. It might mean blessing that person who badmouths you. I had one of my sailors in the last ship who was very experienced. He'd worked in the Navy for 25 years. He was an engineer, and he was a very tricky character, very challenging. But I'd seen that no previous captain of his had written him up for a meritorious service medal, and yet his service deserved it. So I took upon myself to write up the citation to send to the honours committee. And there's a huge amount of work involved in that, hours of work perfecting it, because they are very difficult to get. So I submitted it after all that work, and I heard back that I'd been successful, that he had been awarded the Meritorious Service Medal. And I was delighted for him, and I told him the news. And he sounded pleased, but then a week later, I received a letter from him, which explained to me all the areas where I was going wrong. All the areas where I'd made mistakes, or all the areas where I was pushing the team too hard, or I was expecting too much. And he, of course, you know, it wasn't just reserved for me, it was reserved for the other officers and whoever he disliked. But I blessed him. It might mean leading with fairness, compassion, and encouragement, not having a favorite. It might mean not getting angry or reacting badly when you hear frustrating news. It might mean saying that you believe in absolutes, you believe in right and wrong, and not moral relativism. It might mean being ready to have an answer for our faith on Monday when you're asked, why you go to church? What do you say? To praise the living God, to worship the God who has saved me, the God who enables me to not be seduced by my success, nor frozen by my failures. But what it does not mean is always being successful. Taking our Christian values and shaping our workplace does not mean that you will always be successful. You will fail from time to time. You will make mistakes. You will miss an opportunity, or you will forget to say the right thing. But dust yourselves down and remember that God is sending you into that place, into that contested ground, to do his work that is so valuable to him, with his blessing, with his help, and his encouragement. Amen.